Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today we are kicking off a week-long series looking at the toxic chemicals in our everyday lives. There are more than 80,000 chemicals in the United States that have not been tested adequately for their health and environmental effects, according to the Natural Resources Defense Council. Companies can claim trade secret protections so that they don't have to disclose the chemicals they use in their products. Back in 1976, Congress enacted the Toxic Substances Control Act in response to growing concerns chemicals pose to public health and the environment. The act was intended to, quote, prevent unreasonable risks of injury to health or the environment associated with the manufacture, processing, distribution, and commerce, use, or disposal of chemical substances, end quote. So here we are 40 years later. How effective has that act been? Well, last year, the American Chemistry Council, 3M, DuPont, Dow, Honeywell, and Koch Industries spent more than $55 million to lobby lawmakers on chemical safety regulations. Also last year, seven of the largest chemical companies, including Dow, DuPont, and Monsanto, spent $25 million to craft an overhaul bill that favored their industry. Joining me today to talk about toxic substances are two guests. Sharon Lerner is an investigative reporter with The Intercept. Sharon covers flame retardant chemicals, the unfolding story of C8, that is the chemical used to develop Teflon, and chemical regulations in the United States. And Sharon joins us from the Argo Studios in New York. Hi, Sharon. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. We're also joined by Daniel Rosenberg. Daniel is a senior attorney at the Natural Resources Defense Council. Daniel works to ensure that federal and state authorities have the ability to regulate toxic chemicals and that industries cannot block or weaken public health or environmental initiatives. And Daniel joins us on the line from Washington. Hi, Daniel. Thank you for joining me.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So, first of all, more than 80,000 chemicals are used in the U.S., and they haven't been adequately tested. That's a huge number. It's really hard to kind of get your head around that. Daniel, can you bring this down to the ground for us? Because, I mean, we're talking about chemicals and everyday items. Those of us, it's just, what, 10 past the hour, we have come in contact with a lot of chemicals already, whether you maybe put gas in your car, put some toothpaste on your teeth, used household cleaners, played with some toys with your kids, ate food. Can you talk a little bit more about this, Daniel, and bring it down to the ground for us?
Yeah, sure. So there are a lot of chemicals that are that we're exposed to in our daily lives. As you said, they're used in many things, some of which we probably more readily think about than others. Some of those things are covered by the main law we're going to talk about today for the next hour, the Toxic Substances Control Act. Others are regulated by different laws, whether it's the pesticide laws or the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. There's a few different laws that touch upon the different chemicals that are used in commerce in all kinds of products. None of those work as well as they should. I think it's probably the consensus that TSCA is the least effective of those. So there are many thousands of chemicals that can be used in the United States. I don't know that they're all used on any given day or at any one time, but those are the ones that have been allowed, that are allowed in commerce, and most of those have not been fully or even adequately tested for their use.
Okay, so most of the 80,000 chemicals have not been adequately tested. Sharon, is there any way to know how often, how many of these chemicals are used on a regular basis, how many chemicals we come into contact with in our daily lives?
I actually don't know so much about that research that's trying to quantify that number. I can tell you to kind of drill down a little further on what Daniel was talking about. I was recently looking into the process of introducing new chemicals onto market, and I know that only 15% of they call them the announcements for new chemicals contain any information about health or safety, which is not required. So I'm sure we're going to get to that, but that's another kind of way of slicing it, and a big part of the problem, I think, has to do with confidentiality, and that a lot of the information that folks would need about chemicals is not made public.
Well, we will talk about how these chemicals enter the market, but first let's talk about some of these laws that are supposed to regulate these chemicals. So first off, the Toxic Substances Control Act, this gets the most attention. And on March 26, 1976, one of the bill's sponsors said, quote, "We can no longer operate under the assumption that what we do not know about a chemical substance cannot hurt us. Tragic results associated with too many toxic substances have taught us that lesson all too well. Chemicals, not people, must be put to the test." This is from Senator Pearson. Chemicals, not people, must be put to the test. Can you give us a little context here, Daniel, and talk about why the Toxic Substances Control Act was introduced and passed?
Yeah, I mean, it comes at the, you know, at the time in the early 70s when a lot of the foundational environmental and public health laws, federal laws, were passed. It's sort of right in there in that period of time when the Clean Air Act, or the modern versions of the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, Safe Drinking Water Act, were all enacted. The RCRA, which dealt with hazardous waste disposal, came a little bit later, and then Superfund also came a little bit. Or no, sorry, RCRA came around the same time, actually 1976, but Superfund came a little bit later, dealing with hazardous waste dumps. That was obviously a time, Earth Day, et cetera, when people were very focused, and there was a lot of policy focus on pollution in its various forms. And as it relates to chemicals, you know, these other statutes, some of the ones I just talked about, the laws were dealing, were good laws actually, but were sort of mostly dealing with end of the pipe, right? What, you know, the air pollution that comes out of smokestacks or comes out of tailpipes. Clean Water Act, same thing. In the Safe Drinking Water Act, what's coming out of your tap or what's coming out of a outfall pipe at a factory into the rivers, but nothing really dealing with chemicals in just sort of in commerce and in products, et cetera. And there wasn't even necessarily that. I mean, there was some recognition, which is a little bit reflected in that comment from Senator Pearson and the Council on Environmental Quality from the White House in the early 70s issued a report kind of raising this other concern about, you know, chemicals being part of our daily commerce. That's not a bad thing necessarily. I mean, things are made of chemicals. So, but, you know, raising concerns about lack of information and, you know, things potentially causing cancer and other health effects, and there needing to be a system in place to review those and make sure they were safe. And then there were some particular concerns at that time. PCBs was one. There were a few other chemicals that were sort of particularly focused on at that time. There's been others since then that have sort of grown in sort of public awareness and concern since then.
And that was Senator James Pearson, a Republican from Kansas, who said chemicals, not people, must be put to the test.
Right. And there was, you know, in general, I mean, I wasn't active on this work in 1976, although actually NRDC was. But, you know, there was certainly that was a time where there was broader bipartisan support for these types of laws. That's not to say there weren't differences and that things were all, you know, everybody holding hands together, but there was a broader middle consensus, I would say, on the need to do something. And then there were certainly debates over what the policy should be and how that should turn out, but it wasn't quite as polarized as it is today. So it's not, and I think it was less common at that time than it might be now. Although, you know, I'd say there are certainly some Republican members now who are would probably say very similar things to Senator Pearson, maybe not quite as many.
Daniel, you recently wrote about loopholes for the chemical industry and amendments to the Toxic Substances Control Act. Can you talk about the current loopholes that exist today that allow these chemicals to enter the market before they're reviewed by the EPA?
Under the current law.
Right.
Yes. Well, so for the new chemicals, there's two kind of big TSCA is sort of divided into two big areas. One is existing chemicals, and one is new chemicals. And there, I can define those. But for the new chemicals, those are things that have been introduced into the marketplace since 1976. So starting with the new TSCA in 1976, companies wanting to introduce chemicals into the marketplace had to provide EPA with a notice, a notification called a pre-manufacture notice, and EPA had 90 days with a little bit of an extension to review those chemicals to determine whether they, you know, posed problems, required additional testing, or could go on the market. And so EPA had some new authority to review new chemicals, which was good, but that authority was limited in ways that have been problematic, and Sharon alluded to one of those earlier. There's no EPA, the statute sets a limit into how much information EPA can require a company to provide for new chemicals. They cannot establish a minimum criteria or data set. It's called a minimum amount of information that a company has to provide about health effects or environmental effects of a chemical. So a company has to provide that information if they have it, or if it's, you know, if they can get it, if they're aware of it, if even if it's not in their possession, but they don't have to generate it if it doesn't exist. And so that has led to the incentive that Sharon talked about, which is that 85%, I think roughly 85% of chemicals that come into EPA, these new chemicals, they come in with proposals that don't have any environmental or health information about the chemical, or only minimal information. And so that has limited EPA's ability to effectively review the safety of those chemicals in the fairly narrow window of time that they have to review most new chemicals.
Sharon, can you elaborate on that and talk about why this is allowed?
Well, I can certainly elaborate on what it means on the ground, as you were putting it earlier. This, you know, so as Daniel was saying, about 85% of chemicals are coming on the market without any health and safety information. And, you know, why that is, you know, because they can, I guess. And then, you know, part of what I've been writing about is that even when there is health and safety information, it is so difficult to get. And not just for not just for folks in the industry, for the public, for even scientists who study this stuff, to actually get their hands on information that's even required by the EPA. So when as Daniel was explaining, when a new chemical, a PMN, is submitted to the EPA, they have 90 days to respond. In some cases, and it's less than half, they require some form of testing. What happens often is that the testing is submitted, and regardless of what those tests say, no one ever sees them again. There are no real consequences. And I know a lot about this particular thing because my last story dealt with one particular chemical, which was a substitute for a chemical that's been used in the production of Teflon and other substances known as C8, and a substitute for that was introduced, had lots of really dangerous or alarming health effects that were documented in studies that were submitted to the EPA, were subsequently filed away, and nobody ever learned about them.
And we had you on a couple of weeks ago talking about DuPont and mm-hmm. what has happened over the past couple of years with litigation. And so years of litigation and a class action lawsuit have revealed that DuPont knew about the health risks of using CA, but it kept its own research confidential as it continued to profit from it. So the obvious question is, you know, has DuPont's use of CA, how is it not subject to testing before it was released on the market?
Right. So, and it's C8 or PFOA. Those are the same chemicals. And it's called C8 because it has eight carbons in the base of it. And as Daniel was saying, there isn't a requirement. First of all, the chemicals, PFOA was made and introduced to the market before TSCA, first made in the 40s. But even if it had been introduced after, TSCA was passed, there is no requirement that they submit health data. And I'm sure we're getting to this, but, you know, as we're revising TSCA, there is still not that requirement. But in any case, there wasn't at the time. So they were able to conduct privately their own research on the chemical. There was eventually in place the requirement legally that they had to submit any reports of substantial risk that they saw. And they did submit some and didn't submit others and were ultimately fined about $16 million for what they withheld. But as I was talking about at the time, that $16 million is virtually nothing. It's a speck compared to the profits they made for them. So it's a very ineffectual fine. But beyond that, you know, my most recent stories then talk about not C8. When C8 was phased out by last year, by 2015, the companies that had used this chemical all had introduced substitutes for it because now they weren't able to use C8 anymore, and many of them came up with similar compounds that were based on a 6-carbon chain. There are C6s. There were the EPA told me that they got 300. PMNs for substitutes for C8 after C8 was phased out or as it was being phased out. So it's not just an issue of you're swapping out one chemical for another. You're swapping in hundreds of chemicals to replace sometimes one. And in each of these instances, there may be health effects. And again, no one is required to submit those. What I ended up writing about with DuPont's substitution for C8, which again is a C6 compound that they call Gen X, is that it was, with that chemical, it was one of those in which the EPA said, after they had submitted a notice that they were going to be introducing a new chemical, the EPA said, okay, well, you need to do these tests, you know, and they listed a whole bunch of tests that needed to be performed. DuPont did that. It complied with a consent order, and it submitted these tests. But interestingly, what I found when I was able to locate the submissions to the EPA, it turned out that the substitute also caused some of the very same health effects that C8 had caused. Again, they weren't required to initially submit it. These were reports that they submitted quietly after it was already on the market, and it showed cancerous tumors, kidney disease, liver degeneration in studies on lab animals. And what's interesting is that those reports ended up being filed away. So you would think that, okay, we have the EPA requiring testing, and we do, and that is a wonderful thing. But the next step ought to be, and if those tests show something worrisome, then there is a next step. And that didn't happen in this case.
And is DuPont conducting these studies, or is it a third independent party?
It was DuPont in most cases. They may have used a contract lab in some cases, but they were still directing the research. I should add that DuPont has spun off the division that dealt with fluorochemicals, so it's now Chemours that owns the chemical.
Well, and it can be confusing to follow C8, PFOA, C6, but at the end of the day, we're talking about the chemical that's used for Teflon, and that Teflon toxin is in the bloodstream of almost every American, probably you and probably me. And according to Sharon's investigation, C8 has recently been detected in upstate New York, in Vermont, in Michigan's Flint River, among other places. It's expected to remain on the planet long after humans are extinct. So just to give you an idea of how ubiquitous this Teflon toxin is, You can find more reporting on this at yourcallradio.org. That is Sharon Lerner. She's an investigative reporter for The Intercept. She's been covering the unfolding story of C8, the chemical used to develop Teflon. We're also joined by Daniel Rosenberg, senior attorney at the Natural Resources Defense Council. And today on Your Call, we are kicking off a week-long series focusing on the toxic chemicals in our everyday lives. More than 80,000 chemicals in the U.S. have not been tested adequately for their health and environmental effects. And if you have any questions about this, we'd love to hear from you. What questions do you have about chemicals, how they're regulated? If you've worked in the chemical industry or you've had exposure to chemicals, we'd love to hear your story. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. And if you work on regulating chemical companies or public health protections, what policy changes do you think need to happen? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Daniel, let's spend a little more time talking about testing and reviews. Are resources and research dollars going into independent studies reviewing the risks of chemicals currently on the market, or are they mostly coming from chemical companies?
Well, I would say that most of that, the testing that's done, is done by the chemical companies. They have the most resources to do that, and so that most of it falls to them. There is some amount of testing that is done by academic laboratories and other independent third-party labs on some chemicals. They may do that based on grants from EPA or National Institute for Environmental Health Sciences, NIEHS. They may, you know, there are some academic researchers who have an interest in a particular chemical or class of chemicals that they want to try and find out more about, whether that's, you know, a particular class of flame retardants or phthalates or things like that. But the first part is most of that work is done by the chemical industry itself. And then the second part of that is that although there is independent academic research going on around the country, there's an ongoing debate that typically it's an ongoing debate over which methods of assessing chemicals are accurate and legitimate and proper for purposes of risk assessment and potentially regulating a chemical. And so sort of underneath a lot of the legislative debate in Congress over TSCA and within EPA and other regulatory agencies is who is doing the better job or who is doing a good job of actually assessing the safety of a chemical. And so the chemical industry's view, I'm obviously painting with a broad brush here, the chemical industries have to follow both for EPA purposes and FDA purposes and maybe other agencies as well, something called good laboratory practices. So they have to keep good records of the testing that they do and the animals used and how the animals are kept and things like that, all of which goes back to some actual scandals around the time of the original TSCA where there was a lot of fraudulent behavior and just sort of sloppy testing being done at labs, industry labs and contract labs that industry used. And so these good laboratory practices were established. So those are important for making sure that there's a paper record of what kind of testing industry does, et cetera. They don't necessarily ensure that the test being done is the one that's going to result in the answer you need about a chemical. They might not be asking the right questions. The study design might not be, you know, what's most important. It might be an underpowered study, meaning it doesn't, you know, have enough animals to be statistically significant. But, industry frequently holds up good laboratory practices as sort of the gold standard for testing. Academic researchers and other researchers of that nature typically don't follow, they're not required to follow the good laboratory practices guidelines, and they, you know, they're working on much smaller scale. They're more focused on kind of new ways of looking at chemicals and figuring out, identifying problems. Not to get too lost in the weeds, it's just two not totally distinct, but varying approaches to these questions of how to examine a chemical safety? Is it just, you know, looking to see how much of a dose, you know, kills a certain number of rats, or looking at the subtleties of low doses and what low doses can do and what kind of different effects you can identify that a chemical may have? And a lot of those smaller academic studies, the industry would criticize those and say, you know, they don't meet GLP standards, or they have these other problems that make them not relevant. So in addition to the sort of overwhelming number of resources, you know, being in, you know, industry has those resources, so they're doing the testing. There's a disparity there, and then there's also just an ongoing debate that EPA and the National Academy of Sciences and other agencies and industry and public interest advocates and academics are engaged in over, you know, what are the right kinds of studies, which studies should count and which shouldn't, what effects are you looking for and how are you looking for them? And those have real importance, because the studies you rely upon and the criteria on which those studies are based can very much determine whether the answer is going to be, you know, chemical X does pose a problem or may pose a risk of a problem, or it's fine. And so that's a whole aspect of this whole issue that's, you know, interesting and probably underexplored.
Today we are talking about toxic chemicals in our everyday lives. 80,000 chemicals have not been tested adequately. Many consumer groups say that real chemical reform would require the EPA to investigate the most dangerous chemicals to ensure their safety. Why isn't that happening, and how can we get there? This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
Your Call on KALW, San Francisco Local Public Radio. To join in today's conversation, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Again, it's toll-free. If you prefer to write rather than call, the email address is feedback@yourcallradio.org. Or if you prefer, you can simply leave a comment on that website, yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock, Reveal. Following that at noon today, it will be Backstory. Alternative Radio at 1, and then this afternoon at 2, the BBC's NewsHour. Here on KALW San Francisco Local Public Radio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll continue our week-long series on toxic chemicals by talking about the safety and regulation of the $71 billion cosmetics industry. The average woman uses 12 personal care products and cosmetics every day, containing about 168 chemicals. But the last time the U.S. passed a cosmetics law was in 1938. Cosmetics are actually one of the least regulated products on the market today. We'll talk about that tomorrow, and we'll take a look at real cosmetics reform. What would that look like? And then we're also going to talk about everyday chemicals we use in our homes, and then chemicals that are used out in the fields and on our food. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are kicking off our week-long series by talking about chemical regulation. There are more than 80,000 chemicals in the U.S. that have not been tested for health and environmental effects. And if you have any questions or comments about this, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. 85% of chemicals come on the market without any health or safety information. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Daniel Rosenberg is a senior attorney at the Natural Resources Defense Council, and Sharon Lerner is an investigative reporter with The Intercept, and she covers these issues extensively. And let's hear from a few callers. Let's go to Meredith in Sacramento. Hi, Meredith. Welcome to the show.
Hi. So my name is Meredith Williams. I'm deputy director here at the Department of Toxic Substances Control, and I wanted to let people know that there are new regulations in California to look at consumer products and the toxic chemicals that are in those products, and to try to find a different way of regulating them so that the regrettable substitutes that you've been talking about are avoided. We asked the manufacturers to look at the chemicals that are in their products and to look for safer alternatives. It's called the California Safer Consumer Products Regulations.
Meredith, can you tell me, what does the Department of Toxic Substance Control do on this issue?
The department does a lot of different things around hazardous chemicals, including cleanup of hazardous waste and permitting of hazardous waste that's transported around the state. But this program came out of a green chemistry law that was put into effect in 2008 to look for a different way to manage and regulate chemicals and to try to drive what they call green chemistry, which is a way of making chemicals safer by design. A lot of times chemists, as they're trained, they don't even learn a thing about toxicology, so they may be designing new molecules and not know what it takes to design them safely. And so we're trying to spur innovation to avoid that kind of chemical whack-a-mole, as we call it, where you just continue to introduce one problem after the next. And we're implementing these regulations by naming specific products with chemicals that are problematic and asking the manufacturers to consider reformulation or redesign.
And how do you do that at the state level when this is a problem across the country? I mean, do you think it's possible to have 50 different laws? It sounds like that would be far too complicated.
Well, that is a concern, and I know manufacturing interests are very concerned that what would happen if 50 states came up with a similar approach, but they were all slightly different. But the fact of the matter is that not that many states can afford to do what California is doing. California has always taken a leadership role when it comes to environmental issues, and people are watching us as a model for how they might do something similar, but very few states are talking about adopting an approach like this. And this approach was definitely adopted in a way to avoid a lot of the challenges associated with the regulations you're talking about, to try to get ahead of these things, to be more proactive. So California is in a position as it stands. However, with the possibility of reform of the Toxic Substances Control Act, TSCA, there is the possibility that states would no longer have the flexibility to do this. There are some of the languages that's been proposed has what we call preemption in it, which would preclude the state from doing some of the things that it does, at least on certain timescales, based on what EPA is doing.
And Meredith, one more question, and I'm really glad you called in. A lot of people are concerned about the influence of lobbyists. And in 2014, California Governor Jerry Brown signed a bill to require labeling on upholstered furniture to tell shoppers whether that furniture contains toxic flame retardant chemicals. And so many families, moms, have worked on this for many, many years. And thanks to an expose in the Chicago Tribune, they showed how chemical companies used lobbying tactics to kill earlier attempts to reform this flammability standard. And so can you talk about just the effect that lobbyists have at the state level?
Well, I can't talk very specifically. That was a very compelling story. That the Chicago Trib series was outstanding. But certainly, if you look at just the level of resources, it is, I mean, I think anybody could do the math and think that the lobbyist representatives are better resourced than a lot of the advocacy groups. But in general, I can't comment on that in particular.
Well, thank you for calling in. That is Meredith calling from the Department of Toxic Substance Control. And actually, the documentary Merchants of Doubt focused on California and what happened with the lobbying and the effect it had on upholstered furniture and efforts to let people know whether toxic flame retardant chemicals are in that furniture. Again, that documentary is Merchants of Doubt, and we did a show about that. Sharon, do you want to talk about the effect of lobbying? Because over the past 4 years, according to the Center for Responsive Politics, the chemical industry has spent more than $245 million on lobbying lawmakers at the federal level.
Well, excuse me, it's surely a huge influence, all that money. And, I mean, we've seen once again a weakened, a bill that we already know doesn't do everything we'd like it to do. We have, TSCA is in the process of being reformed, as
we were discussing, a bill has passed both the House and Senate. But neither one, for instance, requires, as we were saying, you know, health and safety data, and neither one really deals with this question of secrecy that I was bringing up before, and I'm going to bring up again because, you know, I did just write about the flame retardants you were talking about, and you know, we know the, as you said, the Chicago Tribune did this great job of exposing the role of lobbying there. And but this, again, the flame retardants have repeatedly been an area where there are substitutions and substitutions. And I was just writing in the piece that was about C6, also about some environmental scientists who are working on some of the newer flame retardants that are, again, replacements for older ones that are being phased out, which the EPA is unable to move forward with the process of regulation of, in part because they can't get all the information they need. And what I mean, and so they need a certain amount of data to be able to decide whether they're, you know, dangerous enough. And they initiated the process to figure out if these things are, you know, dangerous enough that they can move forward. But when you look at the bits of information that are legally withheld, most of the times legally, by the flame retardant industry, it becomes clear why they aren't able to regulate them. And I we actually linked to some of the consent orders and other documents around these chemicals, which, you know, the production, the name of the chemical, the company that makes them, the name of the chemical structure, the amount of chemical that is produced each year, all this stuff is redacted from documents, and it becomes really, really unclear what they are and what dangers they present. So, you know, there are two of the EPA is in the midst of trying to grapple with the regulation of this one class of flame retardants now that contains seven different, there's seven different chemicals in that group. And two of them are just labeled in the EPA's own reports, confidential A and confidential B. And the things that they write about these confidential chemicals, that they pose a number of kind of dangers in terms of health, that they, you know, cause DNA damage and lung damage and are potentially persistent and toxic and pose a threat to the environment, all these kinds of things. And yet we're unable to tell if they ever required testing of it or if, you know, what that testing showed again. So this, I think, is a huge problem when it comes to the dangers that chemicals pose, that at this point, the industry is able to withhold lots of information because they argue it contains trade secrets. And without that, scientists are unable to move forward, and also the EPA regulators are unable to move forward because they can't even figure out what they are.
Mm. Well, thank you again for calling, Meredith. I should say that Meredith was calling from the Department of Toxic Substance Control in Sacramento. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. Let's go next to Sam in Berkeley. Hi, Sam. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning. Actually, I'm in San Francisco, and I don't know if this question is relevant to today's panel, but my question is simply about household tap water, particularly in San Francisco, and is it, you know, it comes from Hetch Hetchy, so is it really safe to drink? That's really my question, if your guests know anything about.
All right, Sam, thank you. We've been covering that, and we did a show recently about tap water and just the safety of water, considering what's happening in Flint, Michigan. Daniel, do you want to take that? I mean, some people are saying the tap water could be great, but maybe your pipes are really old, and that's something to be concerned about.
Old pipes can definitely be a concern, obviously including the issue of, you know, lead, for one thing. We actually do work on drinking water quite a bit, and we are the group that brought a lawsuit over the Flint, Michigan crisis that's underway now. But I can't really go into much greater detail than that. I mean, you know, there are a lot of different contaminants that might be in people's drinking water around the country. EPA, well, so the Safe Drinking Water Act is the law that sets the standards for water coming out of your tap. The law was last reauthorized in 1986. And since then, there was a couple things that EPA was required specifically to set standards for in the 1986 law. So they did those. Since then, they haven't set, a new drinking water standard since 1986. The revised law, the previous law required, version of the law required EPA to set, I can't remember the exact number, but it was something like 15 new health standards every I think it was every 3 years. I might have those numbers not quite right. But anyway, there was a minimum number of health standards, meaning tap water standards, that EPA was required to set every 3 years. And that was taken out in 1986 because drinking water systems were rebelling against that onerous mandate, and they argued it was an unfunded mandate, I think, or some of the localities did. So anyway, that was taken out, and instead a new system was put in, structure was put in place where EPA had to come up with a list of chemicals to consider monitoring and consider setting safety standards for, and they had to review the list every X number of years to decide whether to set a safety standard. The long and the short of it is, since 1986 through, you know, numerous various administrations, both Republican and Democrat, they haven't set a new drinking water, tap water standard. So that's another area where, I mean, there's quite a few tap water standards in place, but it's another area where the federal law is not functioning, I would argue, appropriately to ensure the protection of the public that was intended.
Well, Sam, thank you. We've been wanting to do a show about testing tap water and how those tests are conducted, because even if you look at San Francisco Water website, their annual water quality report of 2014, it's very vague. It basically says contaminants that may be present, may is the key word there, may be present include microbial contaminants such as viruses and bacteria, pesticides and herbicides that may come from a variety of sources such as agriculture and residential uses, radioactive contaminants, but it's really vague. So we've been wanting to do a show about this. I'll add it to the list. Thank you for calling in. And let's go next to Daniel in Oakland. Hi, Daniel. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thank you for your show. All your shows are really great.
Thank you.
I like Meredith's idea of chemical whack-a-mole. That was a great image. my question really is, why do companies like DuPont and other repeat offenders when it comes to health issues, why are they allowed to continue in business? And why aren't they more stringently regulated than other non-offending companies? And why are there never any criminal proceedings against people who are people or companies who knowingly involve themselves in harming public health?
Thank you, Daniel. Good question. Sharon, do you want to take that? I mean, DuPont is going to be in litigation for many years to come, but they're still doing business.
So they are in litigation already, but he has a really good point. It's so difficult to hold people or companies accountable here. So DuPont is in the midst of handling some 3,500 lawsuits that grew out of a class action suit in West Virginia and Ohio. But really, that's a significant, potentially significant liability for them. Part of the way they've handled it, though, is to spin off the company Chemours, which is now sort of handling the liability and handling the chemicals that pose the threat in the beginning. But the biggest way that you could hold these companies accountable, you know, those charges are civil. But, these laws that Daniel's been talking about, TSCA and the Clean Water Act or the Safe Drinking Water Act, you know, if you... In the case of DuPont, if the chemical that we've been talking about, C8, were regulated under any of these laws, then the company that put the chemical into the water, and in many cases it's DuPont, but there are others as well, 3M and other companies that used and made these substances, they could be held responsible for the cost of removing it. Now, that would be a huge step toward making these companies accountable. And why isn't that happening? That's a question that comes back to the EPA. So they have been saying in various letters and communications over the years that they're going to move forward with regulation of this chemical. At this point, they've just set this provisional health level, which is not enforceable. So you can't use it to have anybody clean up the water, even though it's popping up all over the place. So why haven't they moved forward with enforceable regulation? I think that people who are fighting for this would say it's the influence of industry chemical companies like DuPont and 3M and others who stand to lose billions of dollars if that were to happen. So I think that's part of the answer.
And the New York Times reported earlier this year that lawmakers are poised to let Monsanto off the hook for decades of poisoning communities with a toxic chemical known to cause cancer and nervous system damage. The Environmental Working Group has been following this. So this provision was slipped at the last minute into the House version H.R. 2576 of a bill to update the Toxic Substances Control Act. Daniel, do you have any updates on this?
Sorry, which chemical was that?
It was, it's going to let Monsanto off the hook for decades for pollution with a family of chemicals, polychlorinated biphenyls, PCBs.
So I'm not super conversant with that provision. I think there's actually language in both the House and the Senate bills. I think the original, I don't know about the EWG report, there was a New York Times story that focused on a particular provision in the House bill. I think the Senate bill does a similar thing, maybe less with less specificity. And it's basically treating things that have already been regulated under previous TSCA as they were, rather than changing the regulation under the new law. I realize that's not all that clear. I'm not super conversant on that particular issue.
Sharon, are you?
I'm not, but I mean, it certainly sounds like the work of good lobbyists.
Well, we'll continue to follow this and give updates, and maybe we can find more information since we're doing this week-long series all week and provide
Daniel. Can I just add, yeah, on the criminal, I mean, I'm not getting so much into criminal prosecution, but just to say, and maybe this is so sort of accepted or background now that people don't really notice it, but you know, and this isn't to let EPA off the hook at all for what they have not done on many things, drinking water and C8 and others. I don't think you can overstate the amount of pressure that EPA, people at EPA go through, political pressure and direct pressure from industry when they try and do pass things, either rules or orders, that are far short of criminal prosecution. I mean, criminal prosecution, I don't actually know how much criminal prosecution there's been under TSCA even, but you just really cannot overstate the amount of presence on Capitol Hill, not just in Congress, but also at the agencies and with the White House and with the Office of Management and Budget. The chemical industry, like many other industries, but we're talking about the chemical industry today, you know, they deploy, and you referenced some lobbying dollars, or maybe Sharon did, a large amount of lobbying dollars that they've spent over the last couple of years. I mean, that's just one sort of sign of the amount of resources. You know, they have scientists that are on that they hire or contract with. They have lobbyists. You just cannot believe how many lobbyists there are, really. So they bring pressure to bear on the agencies all the time, and on the White House all the time, and on Congress all the time. And they it's hard for EPA to do very much. And I think they should do more, and I think they could do more. And it's a problem, that isn't even necessarily, a Republican or a Democratic administration. You can have problems in both. When people talk about how much, whether it's the chemical industry or some of these other big industries, have a lot of clout and say in Washington, I mean, that is definitely true in a way that is quite discouraging.
And again, over the past 4 years, the chemical industry spent $245 million on lobbying. Sharon, you wanted to jump in?
Yeah, I wanted to add to that, to give a little example, which I found really kind of illuminating when I was trying to understand this whole secrecy issue with chemicals. And, you know, so many times, as I was mentioning before, chemical companies will submit this information and then have it classified so nobody can see it. There is the sense, and I think that it's true, but it's impossible to prove, that they are overusing this CBI classification. It's impossible to prove because the information you would need to do it is classified. Anyway, but when I was trying to figure out how this came to be, one of the things I realized was that in the original TSCA, the way it's written is that the EPA could be fined really hefty fines if they are found to have revealed anything that is supposed to be classified like CBI for a company. So if they reveal anything that's supposed to be secret, a company can fine them. However, if, according to the law, the company does, you know, falsely claim something as CBI, if they're allowed to, if they use this loophole and somehow we figure out that they lied to do it, there are no consequences for mm-hmm. them. So it's like built into the law. And that's the kind of thing that happens when you have a lot of lobbyists working on a law, lobbyists for industry who understand the sort of little tiny, you know, little tiny provisions that really end up affecting us all in this huge way, but it's very, it's subtle. Mm-hmm. I mean, the process of making it that way is subtle.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, but we are going to continue covering toxic chemicals throughout the week. And I know I didn't get to all of your phone calls and emails, but we will be saving your questions because they definitely apply to all of the shows we're doing this week. Sharon Lerner is an investigative reporter with The Intercept who covers chemicals, especially the story of C8, the chemical used to develop Teflon. And Daniel Rosenberg is a senior attorney at the Natural Resources Defense Council. Sharon and Daniel, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, we'll continue our week-long series on toxic chemicals by discussing the safety and regulation of the $71 billion cosmetics industry. Even though the average woman uses 12 products a day containing 168 chemicals, the last time the U.S. passed a cosmetics law was in 1938. So why are cosmetics one of the least regulated products on the market today? And what would real cosmetic reform look like? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.